Hello and welcome to Fine Print, to the double scrutiny of the story and its coverage with me, Amir Afab. But first, as always, we start with a quick check of the big print. The big print goes. Bush Maliki signed pact on Iraq's future. Bush Maliki signed Iraq-U.S. relations plan. Bush commits troops to Iraq for the long term. Iraq politicians oppose U.S. pact. And U.S.-Iraq agree to principles for future relationship. To help us track the fine print, we're joined from London by Sabah Jawad, Iraqi political expert, director of Iraqi Democrats Against Occupations. From New York by Dr. Edward Nell, professor of economics at the New School University. His latest article entitled The Iraq War and the World Oil Economy, and his upcoming book is entitled Oil, Iraq, and Fundamentalism. From New York, we're joined by Matthew Reese, professor of journalism, City University of New York, a documentary filmmaker also. By the phone from London by Dr. Talib Al-Sarraf, Iraqi political analyst. But first, with our first pick tonight, first and foremost, a CNN article titled U.S.-Iraq Signed Plan for Long-Term Relations. And it starts, U.S. and Iraqi leaders signed a plan for bilateral relations, setting the stage for formal negotiations about long-term presence of American troops in Iraq. Let's go to London, where we're joined by Sabah Jawad, our Iraqi political analyst. All right. Yes, let's go to Nell and New York.
Hello,
by the All right. Sabah Jawad, you're telling me we have you back on. That's a pleasure. Sabah, let's have your take on the fine print of this deal.
Right. I mean, this is a continuation. It's a charter, actually, for continuous intervention in Iraq and continuous occupation of Iraq, despite the fact that most of the U.S. troops will be, or at least substantial part of the U.S. troops will be withdrawn from Iraq. But we're talking about here is what we anticipated from the beginning when we said, and a lot of people supported this argument, that the United States is in Iraq because of a long-term plan to control the country and to make it a staging point for further aggression and occupations of the Middle East resources. We know that the plan originally was to make Iraq a satellite state where it has the trimming and decorations of democracy and constitution and sovereignty, but in fact nothing of that sort happened in the past 4.5 years of the occupation. And this memorandum of understanding of future relationship between al-Maliki government and the Bush administration is a continuation of the occupation, because what the United States is planning to do is to remain in six huge secured military bases they are building in Iraq, maybe leaving 50,000 troops in Iraq to undertake security which violate Iraqi sovereignty and protect impose the political conditions on Iraq and economic conditions on Iraq, economic free market and so on, which the United States implemented in other parts of the world, and it violates the sovereignty of these countries. The United States want that Iraqi economy to be owned by the multinational oil companies and by the foreign banks as well.
All right, a lot of fine prints out there. You covered a lot of ground. Let's go back to CNN article, which reads on the President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki on Monday signed the non-binding agreement via video conference. The plan is based on a more informal agreement between the U.S. and Iraq that was developed in August and discussed in September during a nationwide address by the president. A joint statement is called the U.S.-Iraq Declaration of Principles for Friendship and Cooperation, which the document says would move both countries closer to normalized bilateral relations. Let's go to Edward now, joining us from New York, author of Oil, Iraq, and Fundamentalism.
Well, I think that this is not really anything new. As long ago as 2004, John Kerry, in his presidential campaign, pointed out that we, the United States, had begun work on 14 hard, that is, very well-secured bases, permanent bases, in Iraq. Since then, that number has been reduced, but the size of some of the bases has been increased. So this is a very long-term plan. And I think if one considers the reasons for going into Iraq, one can see that the United States never meant for it to be a short-term relationship. Indeed, that goes back to Saddam Hussein. It should be remembered that Saddam Hussein was considered a close and reliable ally of the United States as early as before he took power. There were long-term relations between Saddam Hussein and the American intelligence community. And we should remember that in 1984, Donald Rumsfeld visited Saddam in Baghdad to work out a military support. So I think that the idea that the United States intends to have a permanent relationship with Iraq, in which Iraq will be in a subordinate position, is very much part of a long-term thinking. And that long-term thinking centers on Iraq's very extensive and only imperfectly explored holdings of oil, which is not only extensive, but also relatively easy to access and would be producible at a very low price. I think this is the really important factor in the long-term relationship.
Now, Edward, give us a fine print of the Iraq oil law, the so-called oil law. There are two very important pieces of legislature pushed by the U.S. into the Iraqi parliament and yet not decided on. One of those happens to be the Iraqi oil law. And according to this oil law, 78.5% in 87.5% of the new oil in Iraq would go to the so-called multinational companies inside Iraq, and the rest would go to some kind of a national fund to be divvied up among the Iraqi people. Now, what is the difference between new oil and old oil? And we know this, one reason why Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, for example, was the phenomenon of slant drilling. So who knows what's new and what's old in Iraq, and how do you find the oil law itself? Give us the fine prints.
Well, there's the dispute over Kuwait goes back a long way. Governments of Iraq in fact, the king at one point wanted to annex Kuwait. And Kuwait was only carved off from the rest of Iraq, and the Iraq itself was created with very arbitrary lines by Winston Churchill at the end of World War I. So the problems with Kuwait are very really go back to the settlement after the First World War. But the slant drilling was clearly something which should not be done. And in Saddam's discussions with April Glaspie, the American ambassador, it was clear that the United States, in a sense, supported Iraq's position that what the Kuwaitis had been doing was not really proper. But the main thing is that the oil which is now known mostly results from explorations undertaken by BP and by other large companies prior to the Iran-Iraq war. And that, to give you a rough figure, there have only been something like 2,000, a little over 2,000 oil wells drilled in the whole of Iraq from the time that oil was discovered. A comparable figure for Texas would be 1 million. So you can understand how unexplored Iraq actually is from the point of view of oil and geology. But it is enough is known to be pretty sure that the official statements of reserves are very much understated. And one finds that the James Baker Institute, for example, in Houston, Texas, estimates that there are probably well over 300 billion barrels of oil in Iraq.
Which
and
dwarfs
all of it is high quality and is readily accessible.
All right,
but it will require, of course, an immense investment in drilling, the laying of pipelines, the building of storage facilities, refining, and so on, in order to convert Iraq from an aging, old technology oil producer into a modern high technology oil producer.
Now let's go.
I think that's what the issue is.
Right.
Because
now we'll get back to the issue of oil, and we'll get back to the issue of oil. Now let's go to Dr. Talib Al-Sarraf joining us from London, political analyst. Dr. Sarraf, I'd like to have your take here on the fine print of this huge milestone in the history of Iraq, a long-term agreement between Nouri al-Maliki, the Iraqi Prime Minister, and U.S. President.
Yes. About the agreement between our Prime Minister, Mr. al-Maliki, and President Bush, it is not unique in the world. As far as I know, there are more than 100 agreements or 100 countries which have agreement with the USA. But the main things to us, the Iraqi and the USA, this bilateral agreement, it shouldn't allow the USA to use Iraq against its neighbor country. If this agreement, which I think and you and everybody know, it will not, the negotiation about this agreement will be in the next August, next year in August. We don't know, we just know roughly the main line, the outline of the of the agreement. We don't know the real content of this agreement. This, it will be, the negotiation, it will be start next year. From now about 9 months. But this agreement, if it's going to bring the democracy to Iraq, which I still have some doubt, and to improve Iraqi economy, which is the infrastructure now in Iraq, it is nearly zero, and the people drinking dirty water, and there is no electricity, and the Iraq, as Mr. Nell said, we have in Iraq more than 300 billion barrel of oil, and our people live under the line of poverty. If the America, the USA is going to start like this, the Iraqi people, I am sure, from now, we have some movement against USA in Iraq, because the people think that they have nothing. And now the USA occupied Iraq more than 4 years. And what the Iraqi people gain from this occupation? If they really want to improve the situation in Iraq economically, politically, and everybody look forward to see these things. But I got really some doubt about the American agreement. It will be the same as we hear now from Annapolis, the agreement between Palestinian people and USA and Israel. At the end, as we expected before, it will be one agreement to add to other agreements, to Madrid agreement, to Oslo agreement. I still have strong doubt about this agreement unless the USA prove it after 9 months or after a year. And that is why the Iraqi people, they don't believe this kind of agreement. This be lateral negotiation. I think it will bring nothing to Iraq for time being or for next year. Maybe if they got real positive pressure, American people, and they want to make a good relationship between Iraq and USA, they have to.
Let's go to New York. Let's go to New York, where we're joined by Matthew Rice, professor of journalism, City University of New York, also documentary filmmaker. Matthew, you're standing by. Right now we have here the White House webpage that has to do with this Declaration of Principles for a Long-Term Relationship of Cooperation and Friendship between the Republic of Iraq and the United States of America. Before we get into the details, give us your preview of this agreement.
Well, we have to understand something coming out of the White House, like something coming out of the media, has a literal connotation and also a political connotation. Before I address the specifics of this, we have to understand why the United States entered Iraq back in a few years ago, in 2003. We're talking about, I heard the other gentleman just a moment ago speaking about how many months or how many years the United States military would stay there and the relationship with which they will conclude their the occupation. But I think we should not be naive about this. Though there are a number of very large permanent military bases that are now U.S. military bases that are now located in Iraq, and a very large embassy as well. These are not temporary installations. I don't see any evidence. I have not yet seen any evidence whatsoever that the intent of the powers that be in New York and Washington have any real intention of ever really leaving Iraq, no more than they wanted to leave South Korea back in the 1950s. With this background, I'm happy to discuss the most recent release from the White House. However, we must take this kind of material that's coming out of the White House media with a grain of salt. It's probably unwise to take it quite literally, as there are interests that are far more important than what there are interests that are quite entrenched, which have a lot of authority over these decisions and when they actually get taken, as far as when or if the United States ever has any intention of ever leaving Iraq.
There are three facets to this Declaration of Principles, if you will. One, first, it says the political, diplomatic, and cultural spheres. The second, further down, and then it happens to be the economic sphere. And the third is the security sphere. On the first sphere, which is the political, diplomatic, and cultural spheres, we have words like supporting the Republic of Iraq against internal and external threats. Sabah Jawad, this pretty much sounds like a quid pro quo. We support you against anything internal or external, you support whatever we have to tell you from contracts that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, as I said earlier, a charter for intervention and maintaining these interventions in Iraq. Because on the one hand, it gets the Iraqi government as well committed to the fight against terrorism and so on, Al-Qaeda and so on. Now, Al-Qaeda did not exist in Iraq before the American intervention there. And therefore, it's kind of like tied Iraq to a threat which does not, it's not manufactured there. It's manufactured only after the American intervention in the area. And the threat of terrorism increased because of that. So, I mean, it's open-ended kind of commitment for the United States to intervene in the affairs of Iraq and also to commit Iraq to causes which it might not be in our national interest to get involved in or to fight Americans' war, if you like, or American aggression in the area, because they could come out with the new definition. They already have different definitions about terrorism and the right of people to resist as well. I mean, basically, they call anybody who is resist occupation in Iraq or in Palestine or in Lebanon or in Iran as terrorists. They define them as terrorists as well. This is not necessarily our way of thinking about these kind of things. We consider the Palestinians, for example, the Lebanese as resistant fighters and they're freedom fighters. So are we going to obey the United States definition of terrorism and their condemnation of the right of people to defend themselves as well? It commits Iraq to so many things. I mean, this is a small picture of what will come out in the future as well, because that will mean, and early on, in fact, somebody mentioned the bases in Iraq. They are building huge bases, and some of them are finished, and some of them are bigger air bases than anything the world have ever seen. In fact, in one of them there is more traffic, capable of receiving more traffic than Heathrow Airport as well. So these are investments for the future. These are investments for long-term presence in Iraq. The United States will not spend this kind of amount and commit themselves to these kind of buildings without knowing full well they are planning to stay in Iraq for a long time, as well having the biggest embassy.
We'll have to leave it right here for the first half of the show. What they want to do in the future is to get the Iraqi government to sit back in their headlines. We'll be back after just a few moments. Don't go away. We're back with the fine print of the deal between the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and U.S. President George W. Bush, so-called Declaration of Principles. Joining us to find the elusive print, well, we have with us tonight from London, Sabah Jawad, Iraqi political expert, director of Iraqi Democrats Against Occupation. From New York, we're joined by Dr. Edward Nell, professor of economics at the New School University. His latest article is entitled The Iraq War and the World Oil Economy, and his upcoming book is entitled Oil, Iraq, and Fundamentalism. From New York, we're joined by Matthew Rice, professor of journalism at City University of New York and documentary filmmaker. By the phone, we're joined from London by Dr. Talib al-Sarraf, Iraqi political analyst. But let's go to White House Forces website, and this on the website, the White House, the Declaration of Principles for a Long-Term Relationship of Cooperation Friendship between the Republic of Iraq and the United States. It covers three spheres signed between the two via teleconference, Maliki and Bush, first being political and diplomatic and cultural spheres, second being economic sphere, and third, security spheres. But it starts with a quid pro quo, with we support you and you support whatever we have for you. Second, it goes straight to economic sphere, which we'll discuss tonight in detail. And third, security. Now, let's go to New York, where we're joined by Professor Matthew Rice. Professor, Rice, I'd like to have your take on A, the political, diplomatic, and cultural spheres within the context of Iraq, its people, its today's politics, and also, let's not forget, the balance of power, the other big countries asking for their piece of the pie.
Diplomacy has not been very big for the last 7 years. The State Department has, for all intents and purposes, been minimalized. The Defense Department is the entity that makes deals in the international sphere these days. And what took place leading up to the invasion of Iraq was identification of Iran, Iraq, and Syria as the axis of evil. Now, they didn't actually, the speech removed Syria from that equation and put North Korea in there. However, if you were to look at the events taking place at the Near East South Asia Policy Directorate of the Pentagon back in 2002 and 2003, you would have seen that everybody was working on the Middle East policy. If you want to talk about politics, I'm not even sure what that means beyond the fact that there was a defense, there was an incursion into the Middle East, and these three countries were the ones against which the United States national security apparatus began to operate. There's a very important document that was written, I believe it was 2000 or 2002, by the leading defense planners for the Bush administration. The title of the document was Securing the Realm. This was a document that was written by a number of Bush administration Pentagon officials in the employ of the campaign of Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli president. The basic statement in this document was we need to break up the nation state of Iraq in order to secure Israel. The other states, Iran and Syria, were also addressed, but we're talking about Iraq today, so let's stick to that. Once the Bush administration seized the White House in 2000, these individuals who had been working on various, from think tanks, etc., for the Israeli government and also for various U.S. think tanks, they became the policymakers, and they carried out the policies that they had planned when they were out of power during the Clinton administration. So in essence, there is a political, the main political effect of the Bush administration is to enter into the Middle East in an aggressive manner to, in effect, to weaken or in effect take apart the states that were threatening Israel. Now, the unique thing about this is not a U.S. security program. This is an Israeli security program that took place. Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, and pretty much most of us in New York who covered the United Nations at the time, we all pretty much knew that that wasn't true. We also were aware that there were nobody in the world had any so-called weapons of mass destruction, or more importantly, no one had any long-range nuclear weapons. The United States was basically a country without a significant enemy. One of the reasons behind this policy is basically the individuals who are involved in weapon sales in Washington and New York have a great deal of influence. And when there was no country after the Soviet Union went out of business in 1989-1990 that could strike the United States with a weapon, there was no enemy country, any risk, it was a great crisis. What took place after that was the missile lobby became very concerned. They joined many of these think tanks, and they began looking for ways of getting business back into the nuclear warhead industry and also the missile, the ICBM industry. And for that matter, the same missiles are also used in anti-ballistic missiles.
Right.
this is one of the main thrusts, the political thrust behind a lot of what's going on now, in the Middle East, as well as throughout the world.
Here. Let's switch spheres here from politics.
Certainly.
The first sphere of this Declaration of Principles. And let's go straight to the second sphere, which has to do with economics, the economic sphere. Professor Edward Nell, here we have a few items. One is productive capabilities of Iraq, supporting productive capabilities, and also a transition to market economy. And then we have the international compact with Iraq, so on and so forth. But all of this begs the question of what exactly does Iraq have economically for the United States other than oil? And I'd like to read the title of another paper, this time by Los Angeles Times, which says cost of wars may reach $3.5 trillion, report says that, of course, by the year 2017. Another congressional report out in the U.S. Putting the cost of Iraq war so far at $1.6 trillion. Now, how do you balance this out economically? Do you think the Iraq war is going to pay off for the Americans? How do you see this?
Oh, I don't think it's going to pay off at all. I think it's turned out to be enormously more expensive than the Bush administration expected. I think it is probably true that the neoconservative group around Rumsfeld and Cheney did believe that by taking over the Iraqi oil and quickly developing production sharing agreements with some of the majors, that they would be able to pay for the rebuilding of Iraq. They thought the war would be very quick, and if you stop and remember, it lasted about 3 weeks. It's since the actual fighting is over that the terrible disasters have taken place. The original idea of going in was a very quick strike, take over, bring in the companies to modernize the oil, shift to a free market economy. The free market economy would unleash the productive forces in Iraq. This was a piece of ideology, but they believed it. And so you didn't really have to plan for the Iraqi economy because the market would take care of it. Let the market work its magic. That is the conservative belief. That was Reagan's belief. That's what the neocons have held all along. And they did not see any need for elaborate planning and elaborate development. By contrast, the State Department had prepared about 5,000 pages of very detailed planning for at the local level, at the regional level, and at the national level for Iraq. So it should be remembered that it wasn't just the neocons that wanted to take over Iraq. There was also a great deal of planning from quite a lot of other establishment forces in Washington. But none of this second planning took place. It was let the free market rule. And the result was a disaster. There was no protection and no security given to government buildings, government agencies, banks. There were huge bank robberies. The water mains burst. There were terrible disasters. Iraq, by the way, has quite a lot of water. It's one of the few countries in the Middle East that has substantial water, and therefore irrigation, and therefore actually it has the potential for some productive agriculture. But its main resource, of course, is oil, and the main thing is to develop production sharing agreements with the majors, which Saddam Hussein had explicitly ruled out. Saddam Hussein was dealing with the Chinese, the Russians, and the French, and he was not dealing with the Americans or the English.
Dr. Tolle,
so I think
right.
that the economic disaster that we see in Iraq, with nearly 4 million refugees, 2 million out of the country, 2 million displaced persons in the country, these are rough and ready figures, but it's enormous considering that the population of Iraq is maybe 28 million. This is a huge proportion of the population that has been displaced. If they try to come back, they're going to find people already occupying their houses, and that's going to be that's going to require some kind of adjudication. But the kind of adjudication that has been taking place in Iraq is basically with guns. So it's likely return of refugees is likely to precipitate further civil war.
Now,
questionable whether the country can hold together rather than dividing into three parts.
Now, speaking of Iraqi refugees, of course, we have here an article from New York Times titled "Iraq Lacks Plan on the Return of Refugees," military says. And here we have a picture of refugees. As you just said, we have 2 to 2.5 million different estimates, of course. Internally displaced persons, around 2 million seeking refuge in neighboring countries, about 1.5 million Iraqis already civilians, dead according to ORB, British polling agency, and of course not much left from the 28 million Iraqi population. Let's go to Dr. Taleb al-Sarraf. Dr. Sarraf, how do you think this deal within all these grisly statistics that we have would go down with the Iraqi public?
Let me go back to Dr. Matthew about when he mentioned the axis of evil, and he mentioned Iran and Syria. I will tell you frankly, the Iraqi people, not the majority, the absolute Iraqi people, they don't agree with this term. And I think it will bring to USA a huge disaster if they involve to attack our Islamic neighbor, Iran. This is the first point. The second point about our oil, we are not going to sell our oil in advance as the Arab leaders, what they done to their country, to their people. The Iraqi oil, it will be free oil, as same as with our neighbor Iran. We have right to sell it to whom we want to sell this, and a free market according to the price of the time. And again, we have not only the oil as a revenue. We have also, as you mentioned, the water, and you know. The pure water in the world, it is not more than 4%. And the Iraq has two main rivers, Euphrates and Tigris, and from the north to the south. We have many resources, and fortunately, you see Iraq as not the richest country now in this time, one of the poorest country. But I believe our leader as Mr. al-Maliki, and now Sayyid Abd al-Aziz al-Hakim, also he took his initiative, and now he's in USA, and we believe these people dealing for the positive situation to prove Iraq situation in security, in economic, in politics, in democracy. We got very outstanding figures, political figures, as I mentioned, Mr. Al-Hakim and others. And our people now speak freely. Like yesterday, I hear Sayyid Mr. Al-Saghir, Jalal Din Al-Saghir, and he mentioned, frankly, we have no power because the American army took everything, and we are only represent a very small portion as Iraqi government. We have really very intellectual, very clever leaders, and they will take us to the positive situation. And I expect from them
Let's go to Sabah Jawad in London. Sabah, let's have your take here. Now, yes, of course, we're hearing from Dr. Al-Sarraf that the Iraqi people are not going to let their oil be eluded away from their hands. But what's happening on the ground in Iraq contradicts that, basically, the deal between Maliki and Bush and long-term contracts already underway in Iraq, and Kirkuk even talking to 20 major oil companies, most of them American oil companies. So we know what's happening on the ground. It contradicts all of this, that yes, while the Iraqi people do not want to give their oil away, their the resources, the natural resources of their country away, but that is not what's happening. Now, how do you see this within the context of, say, 10 to 20 to 30 years from now with the Iraqi people? Do you think this is going down very well? And as this country actually is not really new to occupation, 100 years of British, hands-on, hands-off occupation with British troops camping out in Basra back in the 1900s, the first decade, when they found oil in southern Iran, Masjid Soleiman.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the name of the game as far as the United States and the multinational oil companies and capitalism is making profit. And in fact, if I just before commenting on the oil law and the situation regarding its present situation in Iraq, let me say that, for example, the United States wanted to make profit out of this war and occupation as well. That's why they went to the area in the first place, and this was the driving force behind the occupation and the war. It wasn't the desire to help the Iraqi people get rid of Saddam and build a better future for themselves. In fact, they got rid of their old friends and allies for 35 years. They created a huge suffering in the area, mass killings of both Iraqi Iranians and Kurds in Iraq before they've fallen out with Saddam Hussein over the Kuwait. And there are many theories even that they tripped Saddam over Kuwait, in fact. There are a new theory coming out now which suggests, in fact, the price for waging war against Iran was Kuwait, and that was promised to Saddam Hussein later on, but then they abandoned him, and they waged the war in 1991. In fact, the United States made a profit out of the war in 1991 against Kuwait, because most of the Arab regimes actually paid up in full and more for the United States to cover the cost of such a war. So the United States wanted in 2003 also to recoup the expenditure occurred with the war and occupation. And they're planning to do that in Iraq, and they're planning to do that for future deals in Iraq. For example, if you open the gates of investment and multinational oil companies, no Iraqi capital could compete with them, because they are much weaker positions than the United States capital as well. And even in the United States economy and the Western economy, you have a lot of protectionism. Why should Iraq flung its door open for such unfair competition with something much more powerful, as well as having the military present in Iraq? You have the huge financial backing from the world superpower and the world's biggest companies as well. We have the situation in Iraq now. They've been trying for months and months to pass this law. This law is based on the production sharing agreement, as has been mentioned before, and which is not in favor, it doesn't favor Iraqi interests at all. In fact, such an agreement only implied in countries where it's very difficult and very unpredictable quantities of oil as well. And normally the costs of such, even if they find the oil, of production is extremely high. Therefore, you entice the companies by giving them a huge amount of profit, because they are risking a capital there. And in the situation of Iraq and most of the Middle East, the oil is there. The reserve is proven reserves as well. And the cost is extremely cheap to extract. Iraqi oil is one of the cheapest oil to extract, in fact, in the area and in the world as well. So you're given something for basically nothing. And Iraqi capability, even now, we have surpluses. You know, the last budget, some minister has been allocated the budget. They didn't even spend half of the budget allocated as well. So Iraqi are able to rely on revenues to finance project. And there are a lot of people are saying, including people in the know of what's happening in Iraq. For example, the leadership of the oil union in Iraq. They've been saying this, the United States policy deliberately running down the Iraqi capability of production in the south of Iraq, because they actually want to prepare the ground for takeover by the multinational companies. They wanted to say to justify the oil law by saying Iraq is not capable of increasing production, for example, until now, the multinational company moves in.
It's quite clear to everyone probably watching this show and also tuning in to this deal between Bush and Maliki that what's really going on. But the question is, given the facts on the ground with the Iraqi people, Professor Matthew Rice, how do you see the future of this deal and other deals? Because serious negotiations are slated for next July 31st, between the U.S. and Iraqi government for continuation of talks and this enduring relationship between two countries. How do you think this would go down with the Iraqi people and looking at the demographics in Iraq?
Well, you mentioned a very, very important figure. Perhaps the most important number or fact that's come up today during the broadcast. And that was the number $3.5 trillion. This is the amount that was estimated in the United States that the United States is spending on war in Iraq. This is enough reason alone for the big companies and the oil companies, which are also the largest defense contractors in the world, to be involved here. So we see that there is a highly economic motivation for America to be in the Middle East, to be in Iraq. On the other side, we have Iraq, and we have the people of Iraq. And the question is, can some good come of this in years ahead? Well, many of my colleague here from from New York mentioned that the neoconservative leaders had stated specifically that by invading Baghdad and invading Iraq, democracy would come over the country. Well, such a thing has never happened before, of course. Democracy is something that one fights for. One is not granted democracy. And so the hope that a system that is more equitable to the people of Iraq than the one that was taking place under the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein, which, as I understand it, is a communist, atheist regime. Is there much hope of that occurring? I'm not holding my breath. I don't expect that to be the case.
All right. Unfortunately,
there's another question. There is another question implicit.
Right. But we have to leave it there for now.
The relationship between U.S. and Iraq.
Hopefully in upcoming shows we'll discuss that, but we have to leave it for now. News is coming up next. So our thanks to all our guests for their time and views. We're joined from London by Sabah Jawad, Iraqi political expert, director of Iraqi Democrats Against Occupation. From New York, we're joined by Dr. Edward Nell, professor of economics, the New School University. And we were also joined tonight from New York by Professor Matthew Rice, Professor of Journalism, City University of New York, and documentary filmmaker. By the phone, we're joined from London by Dr. Talib Al-Sarraf, Iraqi political analyst. Our thanks also to our viewers for joining us. Always watch out for the fine print.